Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I was lying in bed one morning, listening to the radio. It was lockdown, and all the talk was about people baking and gardening and how strange this new reality was. I thought about the spider plant on my hall table that I'd been ignoring for years. I'd only remembered to water it the odd time, so it always looked a bit bedraggled. But since lockdown, I'd been checking in on it every day. Watering it, talking to it. I'd even given it a name, Robert Plant. I lay there thinking when I might get back to what I do, comedy. All the comedy clubs were closed and would be for many months to come. I'd done some gigs via Zoom. I'd even included Robert Plant in one of them. He was a hit. People appreciate greenery wherever it pops up. But Zoom was clearly no substitute for live performance. I was mid-reverie, examining a crack on the ceiling, when a bird flew into my bedroom. It flew frantically from one side of the room to the other and back. I got a terrible fright. I looked over at my cat, Doris, who was curled up on the floor underneath the window, enjoying the morning sunlight, and she looked back at me as if to say, "Are you seeing this? There's a bird in the bedroom." The bird landed on my clothes rail. It was hopping from hanger to hanger, hiding between the clothes. It was small and brown, and I later discovered, thanks to the Birdwatch Ireland website, it was a wren. I knew I needed to get the bird away from the cat, so I tiptoed up to my clothes rail and I cradled it in my hands. I was afraid it might peck me, but no, it was very still. I carried it to the bathroom because I knew it must have got in through the window I had left slightly open. I tried to release it through the gap, but it was too narrow, so I had to place the bird on the windowsill whilst I opened the window wider. It was perfectly calm, waiting for me to do this. I could have been a chauffeur opening a door for a client. The minute there was enough space, it shot straight out at great speed, as if it knew exactly where it was going. This was the most exciting thing that had happened all week. The more I thought of it, the more incredible it became. What were the chances of that bird finding that gap in the window and managing to make its way in? I searched online for the symbolic meaning of a bird visiting your home. Apparently, it was a symbol of freedom and that there was a message on the way, and also good luck, and also bad luck if the bird died or was white. I was in luck. My bird was brown. I decided the bird was a symbol of freedom during our self-imposed captivity. Maybe the message part would become clearer over the next few days. Or perhaps the bird was the message. Fly, take risks. Something will intervene to take care of you and make sure you don't get killed by a cat. This message would apply after lockdown, obviously. The following morning, I was in the kitchen and a bird flew out from behind the door. I got a terrible fright. Again. It landed on top of the fridge. It was a wren. It had to be the same bird. Without thinking, I ran to the window and opened it, and once again, the bird shot off as if it knew exactly where it was going. Although, now, I had to question if that bird had any idea what it was up to. The day before, I'd projected a lot onto that bird. Now, I stood in its wake, confused. What was the message in this second appearance? Beyond close the bathroom window. In comedy and drama, there's a thing called the rule of three. It's a pattern that people find pleasing. I don't know why, but it's a fairly standard format that every comedian and dramatist knows. Three blind mice, the three bears, the three musketeers. We like things in threes. I really wanted the bird to come back the following day. I left the window open But he didn't reappear that day, or the next day, or the next. The bird wouldn't come back, I slowly realised, because it was a bird. It didn't know the rule of three was a more satisfying structure for our encounter. It didn't know that by coming back the second time, but not a third, it had just made everything weird.
Three is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number. Somewhere in the ancient mystic trinity, you get three as a magic number. The past and the present and the future, faith and hope and charity, the heart and the brain and the body.
I was watching Jon Pertwee's Doctor Who, the 1970s incarnation of the time-travelling hero, doing his level best not to get exterminated by aliens inside deadly robot bodies in the Day of the Daleks, when my father said I had to run to the nearest phone to call the AI. Normally, we'd walk a cow in heat to the bull, but to improve the quality of an aging herd, he was resorting to the AI instead. Not artificial intelligence, but the Artificial Insemination Service in Sligo. The Time Lord and his sidekicks abandoned to their fate, I raced to get hold of the shopkeeper who kept a telephone in the passageway between the shop and her private residence. "Hello, Mrs. Galooly," I blurted. "We have a cow on the rambles." She led me to a big black wall-mounted phone and roused the postmistress on the local switchboard, who called the main exchange. From there, the operator alerted the AI's dispatch office. Knowing our cow wouldn't stay in heat for very long, but if I made a mistake in my hurry, I hadn't the price of another call, I gingerly fed my sweaty palm full of coins into three different slots and pressed button A. The right order of coins went down the right way. I was through to the AI. "When did you notice her?" the dispatcher asked. "This morning," I said. "Is it her first time?" It never occurred to me to ask, was our cow a virgin or not? I wasn't even sure I was supposed to know such things. "I think so," I stammered, realising only after I said it that what they really wanted to know was whether the AI had been called out before to inseminate the same animal. There was no charge for a repeat call, but it was a black mark against the AI service to have too many repeat calls, resulting in late calving. "Watch the skies," American B-movies warned citizens against alien spacecraft arriving to conquer our world. And I kept an equally keen lookout until a car pulled up in our farmyard and I shouted, "The AI man's landed." He even wore sci-fi white Wellington boots, and ignoring the warnings to keep out from under the man's feet, I watched him extract a slim, pristine, clear tube from a canister, wafting its dry ice haze, like the liquid oxygen and nitrogen clouds venting from a Saturn V rocket on the launch pad at Cape Canaveral. With a flimsy, transparent glove reaching up his arm, the AI man took the tube to our cow in the barn. Afterwards, we left out a bar of pink carbolic soap, a hand towel, and a bucket of lukewarm water for him to scrub up. Apart from this simple courtesy, a docket and the discarded launch tube were the only traces of his visit. 9 months later, the first water bag appeared and our cow stood stock still in the barn, big-eyed and chewing the cud, sick with the pangs of birth. A whispered debate between my mother and father took place in the yard on the proper moment to intervene. Any unnecessary commotion could unsettle the cow and postpone or even threaten the delivery. Wait too long and the outcome might be equally devastating. My father hunkered in the yard and smoked several cigarettes. Finally, he said, the cow was in difficulty. My mother asked if she should run for a neighbour to help. My father said there was no time and he swooped with a rope and looped it around the only part of the calf to have appeared yet, the hooves. What followed was a heart-stopping battle for the life of the larger-than-normal calf to be delivered. I joined my father, pulling on the rope, and was astonished at how hard we could pull, and still the calf wouldn't budge. My father used his bare arm to locate the head. We pulled harder. And then, miraculously, the calf slithered smoothly free and hit the straw in a glisten of afterbirth. Its mouth and nostrils were cleared quickly by hand, and the hanging tongue stirred in protest at being dragged roaring into the world. A beautiful, healthy, fawn-coloured bull calf. The first Charolais cross calf ever born on the farm. The future had arrived, not in the form of a Dalek invasion, or a flying saucer from beyond our solar system, but in the shape of an AI man from Sligo, up to his elbows in animal health and worried about repeat calls.
Having watched Wuthering Heights on TV recently, I was, as I've been every time I've seen it, roused to fury at Hollywood's ability to pound literary classics into sentimental mush. In this 1939 case, it reduced Emily Bronte's gothic 1847 novel of obsession and revenge and tidied it into costumes that would have graced the court of St. James, complete with crown jewels, when the reality would have been muddied, smelly, and nondescript. It gave us the wild, brooding, untamed and untamable Heathcliff, billowed in snowy linen shirts, a carefully floating forelock, and a jutted jaw from Laurence Olivier, with fluttering eyelashes and a sweet simper from Merle Oberon as Cathy. They hardly suggested Bronte's outcome. That was Heathcliff raging against fate, arranging to have the sexton dig his grave alongside Cathy's, but to break through the sides of Cathy's coffin and his own, so that when Edgar Linton's remains decayed into them, he would not be able to tell them apart. Not exactly pretty. But there's something of significance in the film as well. One of the 8 Oscar nominations it received was for Best Supporting Actress, for Geraldine Fitzgerald in the role of Isabella, Linton's sister, whom Heathcliff marries in order to destroy his rival through his brutal ill-treatment of her. The first shot in which she appears is as a sluttish, middle-aged woman, lined, bitter and filthy, before the film goes into flashback to show Isabella Linton as a besotted young beauty on the verge of ruin at the hands of Heathcliff. There is more than one dynastic name in Irish theatre. Fitzgerald is one of them. Linked together, in a family that includes Sheila Richards and Dennis Johnson, and gathering in Michael Lindsay-Hogg, the eminent movie director, Tara Fitzgerald, the film actress, Caroline Fitzgerald, the Dublin theatre director, and the late wonderful actor Susan Fitzgerald. And that's why Geraldine Fitzgerald's luminous beauty seems so familiar on film. Susan was her niece and almost eerily like her. And Michael Lindsay-Hogg is her son. Quite a dynasty, with Geraldine as almost a founding member deserving to be better remembered and honoured than she is. She only died in 2005 at the age of 91, after slipping into Alzheimer's disease a number of years earlier. Having begun her career at the Gate Theatre in 1932, her first film role was in 1937 in a British production of George Eliot's The Mill on the Floss. A year later, she was on the way to US stardom when she played opposite Orson Welles in Shaw's Heartbreak House at the Mercury Theatre in New York. The relationship was rumoured to extend offstage, and in later years there were stories that Welles was little Michael's father, which Michael himself believes, although Patrick McGilligan's 2015 biography of Welles suggests the dates didn't match, despite a genuinely uncanny resemblance between the adult Michael Lindsay-Hogg and Welles. They relate to a time when transatlantic travel was less frequent than it is now, and biology would have had to travel a long way after Geraldine returned briefly to London. But in 1939, she was in the States, this time on the West Coast and working on Wuthering Heights. The atmosphere appears to have been torrid, with Olivier and Oberon loathing each other and saying so, and director William Wyler suffering with less than patience the interference of his producer, the infamous Sam Goldwyn, never known for subtlety or good taste. The wincingly sentimental final scene of the film is now known to have been added by Goldwyn after Wyler signed off on the work. Perhaps he was one of those with a verbal contract not worth the paper it's written on, as Goldwyn is famous for having said. Geraldine had already completed work on Dark Victory with Bette Davis to universally good notices, and she went on to play a number of featured roles. But they became less impressive and less noteworthy. Geraldine Fitzgerald was trouble. Admirable trouble in ways that today's hashtag MeToo Hollywood women would recognise. But in Fitzgerald's heyday, it wasn't that they waited for collegiality to complain. They didn't complain at all. But Fitzgerald did. She fought back when she felt demeaned and the hierarchy didn't like her. So she packed her trunks and by 1946 was back in New York, where she returned to the stage, not in a blaze of glory, but in a solid, much-admired and serious career. Even so, Hollywood didn't forget her. In 1960, her film work was rewarded with a star on Hollywood's Walk of Fame. But one wonders now whether she might not have regarded that with a certain amount of cynicism. She had other fish to fry. That included founding the Everyman Theatre of Brooklyn, a street theatre group, and an acclaimed performance as Mary Tyrone in a Broadway production of Long Day's Journey into Night. And in 1982, she was one of the first women to receive a Director Tony nomination on Broadway for a production of Mass Appeal. The previous year had seen a return to film to play Dudley Moore's dotty grandmother in Arthur. There was only about 20 years between them. While on the small screen, she was Rose Kennedy in the series Kennedy with Martin Sheen. Comedy brought yet another award. In 1988, a guest appearance on the hit TV comedy The Golden Girls won her an Emmy nomination. One can't help wondering what happened. A bit part in a Hollywood movie is usually enough to ensure permanent celebratory frenzy in Ireland. So why have we forgotten Wicklow woman Geraldine Fitzgerald, feisty star, and a member of the American Theatre Hall of Fame. She deserves better.
Thank you. I have a friend who won't let her husband use the sat-nav when she is in the car because she's jealous of the female voice giving instructions to her husband and the way he listens so intently and does whatever she says. The female voice on my husband's Google map sounds like a nervous type, slightly hysterical, like she might have a hissy fit if he doesn't make that turn. So I'm more irritated with her than jealous. The voice on my phone sat-nav sounds confident and bossy. "Turn right," she says, with such authority that I drive through red lights. Then there is that annoying little dudda when I'm navigating through Waterford, which tells me that I've taken the wrong turn, or the dudda on the dark country road because she has misread a turn as a bend in the road. I curse at her then, call her stupid woman. With all the jokes when I was growing up about women not being able to drive, reverse, park, you get a truck in there, love. This is not a good thing. Last year, I had to make two journeys, one to the north of Ireland to stay for 2 nights and then back to Dublin Airport to fly to Exeter. On the way, I called in to see my daughter, Shell. We were standing in her kitchen. "I'm so proud of myself for packing two separate bags," I told her. "One for the north and another that will fit on the plane to Exeter." "I'm delighted to hear that," a female voice announced. We looked at each other, then around the kitchen. Perhaps it was a spirit guide encouraging me on my travels. But no, it turned out that the phone had been listening and was now interrupting and making comments. I held out for a long time before getting a mobile phone, put off by stories about text messages that had gone to the wrong person. The husband or wife instead of the lover, say. And I avoided social media for many peaceful years. But I eventually succumbed, and now I Zoom and Skype and make knee-jerk comments on social media with the best of them. I consider myself au fait with all the latest messaging technology. So when I read a message telling me that a friend who was travelling in India wanted to send me a message, but I had to sign up to yet another messaging app to receive it, no problem. I followed the instructions, I gave my name, email, and even uploaded my photograph. Suddenly, I was on the site. Horrified, I saw my photograph beside women who seemed to be pushing out their breasts and smiling in that inviting way. Beside them, my photograph took on dimensions I had not known it had, as over my head I read the legend, "New, Lanny from Limerick." I closed it down in fright, and it wasn't until the next morning I woke up with the realisation that this was some kind of hacking thing and I needed to sort it out. I opened it up again to find messages from strange men. Sweating with embarrassment, I scrolled downwards, trying to find a way to unsubscribe, but had to answer a series of questions. Why do you want to unsubscribe? Is it A, this, or B, that? All of this kept me late for the poetry workshop I was attending in Dungarvan, facilitated by a male poet whose work I admired. Still flustered, I slipped into my seat around the table with the other writers. "Sorry to be late. My phone was hacked and it took ages to sort it." "Yes," the poet said. "I got a strange message from you." "Mmm," the other said. "Me too." "Well, definitely don't open it or you'll be hacked as well." "But I did open it," the poet said. "And your photograph was up there." "Oh God, yes, I did that by mistake." He looked sceptical, as I imagined the words "New, Lanny from Limerick" flashing in neon capitals above my head. Another time, I was trying to send a message to a few people on Messenger. I swiped or pressed something and inadvertently set up a group. I started getting messages from various people from different backgrounds. "What group is this?" "Sorry," I said, "didn't mean to set up a group." "Let's start a group anyway," some of my writer friends suggested, becoming creative and naming the group Mysterious Cult, with plans for Howling at the Moon get-together and adding a strange medieval icon for our logo. After a giggle at all this, I checked who exactly was in this group I'd created and found that one was a troublesome person I thought I'd blocked and another a prospective employer, and I was sending them invitations to come and howl at the moon with me. So I think I'm going to go to the phone shop to check out the old brick phone that only makes phone calls and sends texts And if you want to contact me, I'm not in Limerick.
It was the finest of fresh summer days. We had just returned from our annual family holidays in the west of Ireland. My father and my younger brother had gone to town. I don't recall the particular nature of the message. Something to do with the imminent back-to-school preparations, no doubt. Looking back, it hardly matters. I was at home with my mother when we heard the almost subdued but unmistakable sound of a bomb explosion. Growing up in the north of Ireland in the 1980s, you knew that sound. "Oh, be careful. Come away from the window," my mother instructed. She was a veteran of paramilitary bombings. Shortly after marrying my father, their first home as man and wife had been destroyed in a bomb attack on the nearby British Army base. On another occasion, she'd been terribly worried about me when my grandmother and I were caught up in a bombing at the local department store in Omagh. But things were different now. This was 1998. We had the peace. In the distance, burglar alarms pulsated out their protest. There was also the whirling of the ambulances, the police Land Rovers, the army helicopters. Dad and my brother Rory soon returned. Thanks be to God. My mother's relief was palpable. But what of my older brother Damien? He had been in town too, and there was no word of him. Dad and I took off to look for him. The scenes we saw were unimaginable. As long as I live, I will never forget. The people of the town who were caught up in the bomb wandered around, many of them dazed and bloodied, their torn clothes the least of their concerns. Many others rushed to help in any way they could. Bus drivers had turned their coaches into makeshift ambulances, ferrying the injured to the nearby county hospital, never designed to cope with such carnage. Women from the local drapery shops collected sheets from the rubble of their crumbling stores to give those who would never be coming home some dignity in death. Our local parish priest, kneeling with tears running down his cheeks, whispered an Ave or a Pater in the ear of a departing soul. It was the 15th of August, the feast day of Mary's Assumption, and I whispered a hurried prayer that Our Lady would cover this town, my hometown Omagh, in her love. A few hours passed. It seemed like an eternity before we saw my brother Damien. We had been going to and fro, anxiously looking for him and trying to make contact. He had been caught up in the explosion, but mercifully uninjured. He stayed to tend to his friends and neighbours who lay maimed and dying. It was such a relief to see him. We were one of the lucky families. The local leisure complex had been turned into what they called a major incident centre. My father and I went there. We weren't sure what, if anything, we could do to help. Dad quickly got a job compiling lists of names family members were anxious to inquire about. I watched as families sat sobbing quietly, anxiously checking lists of names being posted on notice boards, or vainly trying to ring mobile phones that would never be answered. Police officers, their own pain and what had happened in their hometown etched on their faces, gently took families aside, one by one, to deliver the terrible news. There was something strangely beautiful about the reverence and dignity amidst the chaos. It was late when we left for home. I watched the 24-hour news channels for a while. The grim picture was the same on every station, in every language. The sad remains of our quiet market town. Sleep didn't come easy that night. As the sirens subsided and the explosive fires were finally brought under control, night turned to day, and the dreadful morning arrived. 29 people, including a woman pregnant with unborn twins, were dead. It wasn't supposed to be like this. I had turned 18 just a few months earlier. My first ever time to vote was to endorse the Good Friday Agreement. This was our future. No longer would we be enemies, but friends. Now here was the dark past, staring us in the face, almost mocking us for daring to believe that things could be better. Bombs don't discriminate. As the names of the dead emerged, there were Protestants, Catholics, and Mormons. There were the Spanish students and their teacher, too, who'd come to the town to celebrate the Carnival Day. They would never grow old. None of those who died would. Yet their faces flash before my eyes now, as fresh as when they were emblazoned on the front page of almost every newspaper in the world. The peace we have now isn't perfect. Peace never is. And there's more, much, much more for the politicians to do. We are all of us marked and wounded by the past, but we can never allow ourselves to be imprisoned by it. History, Maya Angelou says, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, but if faced with courage, need not be lived again. Life goes on in Omagh now. It's not the first town to be scarred by senseless violence, and it won't be the last. But for me, the Omagh of my carefree childhood will be forever marked by what happened that Assumption Day.
On this morning's programme, we heard Rule of Three by Pauline Shanahan, Doctor Who and the AI Man by Brian Leyden. The Hollywood star who fought back long before Me Too was by Emer O'Kelly. Lanny from Limerick by Lanny O'Hanlon. And finally, Omagh, August 1998, was by Michael Kelly. And the music was Three is a Magic Number by Bob Durrow, the theme from Doctor Who by the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, Nocturne No. 1 in E-flat Major by John Field, played on piano by Elizabeth Joy Rowe, and Telephone and Rubber Band by the Penguin Cafe Orchestra. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.